It's God's will. Even if you hate it, you have to do it. I know you can see the errors in that a mile away, but that's how our weird little ideas are, so obvious to someone else, but impossible to detangle ourselves. I saw myself as a ball of energy, a firework, a high-capacity person, fearless and up for anything. But as I became more honest with myself, I didn't want the lifestyle being offered to me. I didn't like who I had to become in order to live in that world. And I didn't feel those good, whole, lovely feelings that people told me I was supposed to feel after doing a good job. One thing I learned, which seems massively obvious in hindsight, we don't all love the same things. Look at your deepest dreams, who you've always been, the things you love even though no one else does, the times in your life when you feel the most beautiful even if no one else thinks so. I found myself drawn more and more back to the water, to simplicity, to the margins and the mystery, to the ideas that don't fit on Twitter, and a sense of nuance that doesn't fly on Facebook. I found myself drawn to the table, old friends, quiet evenings, books, to home and family, life spent on porches, free of makeup and microphones. I found my way back to the girl I was in high school, in college, a hippie-ish bookworm who loved the simplicity of having everything she needed in a backpack. There's something, I'm sure, about going back to the places you used to go to find the self you used to be. Maybe my long-ago essential self is more readily apparent here on these docks and benches and flaking chairs because so much of my life was spent here. Maybe that's why life at the lake continues to move me so deeply, because it draws me back to my past, who I've always been, under the recent shell I've been wearing, achievement, efficiency, productivity. Heart and yes. I remember the buzz of the needle from my first and second tattoos, that metallic rattle, high-pitched. It makes the muscles in my neck twitch, remembering the nagging pain that goes with the buzzing sound. I got my first tattoo during my senior year of high school on Kazimierz Pulaski Day, a school holiday in Chicago thanks to the large Polish community. I told my parents I was going to do it, but they weren't too worried. I'd been fainting at the sight of a needle all my life, in doctor's offices, at the mall, getting my ears pierced. When I came home and showed my mom the small Chinese symbol under the bandage, my mom said, "Bill, you're not going to believe this." 2 years later in Santa Barbara, a redheaded man named Sebastian put a small vine on my toe and a tiny butterfly on my best friend Annette's toe. We were 19 then, and now 19 years later, here I am again, that buzzing sound ringing in my ears, offering up the tender pale flesh of my forearms, a heart on one, the word yes in my friend Lindsay's elegant cursive on the other, navy and careful. The heart, blood red, perfectly simple, just exactly the way a child would draw it, is about love, of course. It's about God's love, about the revolutionary and foreign idea that I'm loved by God no matter what. Every Christian learns that early on. But that wild love is a difficult one to experience for many of us. For me, I understand conditions, proving, record-keeping, tallies of grievances and offenses. I don't know much about unconditional. I feel like I'm just beginning to taste it for the first time. When I pray, I picture a red heart, that perfectly simple red heart. And in the silence, I'm reminded of God's love. That it began before I was born. That it will continue far past the end of my life. Before the day begins, kids, coffee, toast, little socks, little shoes, deadlines and decisions. Before all that, I close my eyes and I picture that red heart. And I remind myself what is true. That God loves me. And that there's nothing I can do in this new day to earn more love, nothing. And also that there's nothing I can do in this new day to ruin or break that love, nothing. I can't imagine anything more life-changing for an earner like me. That love is secure no matter what, no matter what, no matter what. No matter what I do or don't do, no matter whether I succeed or fail, no matter if I perform well or fall apart. When I begin the day drenched in that love, that centering awareness of my worth and connection to God, the day is different. I don't have to scramble or hustle. Fear dissipates, and what I'm left with is warmth, creativity, generosity. I can make and connect and create and tell the truth because my worth isn't on the line every time at every moment. Unconditional love changes everything. It is changing everything. I can rest. I can fail. I can admit need and weakness. I can exhale. It's changing everything. And so that red heart, I wanted to carry it with me, and I wanted it on my left arm. I'm left-handed, and I want that love to be the fuel. Whatever I build from here on out, whatever I make, whatever I write, whatever I create, I want the fuel that propels it to be love, not competition, not fear, not proving. And yes, the words sparked for me for the first time 2 summers ago when I was right smack dab in the middle of the lost, rushed, push, push, push season, aching for a change I didn't yet have the words to articulate. I went on a retreat, that same retreat where I learned to throw candy once again. As I sat at O'Hare ready to depart, I texted a friend who'd been on the same retreat the summer before. "What am I getting myself into?" I asked. "What do I need to know?" My friend Chris, who I've known for many years, who's been a big brother and encourager for almost a decade, replied with this: "Say yes, jump, hog the coconut shrimp." I didn't know what any of it meant, of course, but a few hours in, I relayed those 3 instructions to my new friends. We did indeed hog the coconut shrimp, and it was impossibly delicious. And then we found ourselves scrambling up a cliff, ready to jump. The men were jumping, and it seemed like maybe the women were going to hang back, appreciate the view. I started to turn back to where the rest of the women were. And then Bryson yelled after me just as I was turning away, "Shauna, hey Shauna, I thought you said we say yes. I thought you told me we jump." And so I jumped. And so I said yes. And that word became a shorthand between us, a symbol for being awake, for being alive, for showing up, for jumping. We texted it across the country to one another. "Are you saying yes? I said yes today. Say yes, say yes, say yes." I bought a sweatshirt that said "Say Yes" in navy and gold, and I wore it constantly like a lucky charm, like a best friend, a reminder of this sweet, wide-open way of living, wholehearted, connected, wholly there. Words that hadn't described me for a long time, but words that I aspire to. Saying yes means not hiding. It means being seen in all your imperfections and insecurities. Saying yes is doing scary things without a guarantee that they'll go perfectly. Saying yes is telling the truth even when it's weird or sad or impossibly messy. Saying yes is inviting chaos and also possibility. Saying yes is building a new future regardless of the past. Saying yes is jumping in anyway. One part of this journey, of course, was learning to say no. I couldn't have remade my life without that very important word, but it's not the word that I want to be my knee-jerk response to all of life. My response to pressure and expectations? No. But the word I want to say to beauty and freedom and soulfulness and life and play and creativity and challenge and God's wild and expansive love? Yes, yes, yes. Always yes. And so those two, the red heart and the word yes, the heart on my writing hand, the invitation yes on the other. My friend Sarah and I drove to the city on a rainy Tuesday, having set aside the afternoon for more than a month. Having talked about this day literally for years, in the middle of the night, sometimes on vacation, we'd say, "Let's do it right now." But we never did, and we always meant to. And then I had a moment, a need to mark this new passage through to a new way of living. And I told her, "I'm going this month. You in?" She was, and we were nervous right when we arrived, jittery, giggly. We talked to each other to take our minds off the needle, chatting about anything we could think of to cut through its noise. We planned a dinner party, talked through the menu and the table settings. We talked about kids and school and capsule wardrobes, and I'm sure all the men, all the tattoo artists, were rolling their eyes at these two moms, chatting the day away, giggly and euphoric. Our old friend Ryan owns the shop. So I'd met most of the artists at Ryan and Emily's wedding last year. I had officiated, and my brother was the best man, and the ceremony was on the rooftop of a glass-blowing factory on a gorgeous, windy spring night. And then exactly a year later, Sarah and I took turns talking each other through the nagging pain. After it was done, we walked around the corner to 11 City Diner, too excited to go straight home. She had a mimosa and French toast, and I had an extra spicy Bloody Mary and a club sandwich, and we sat so happily on that foggy, cool day in the warm diner, high-ceilinged and classic. I know some people think tattoos are insane or tacky or passé, but for me, these are the lines I've drawn in the sand, the daily, visual, tactile, with me all the time, twin symbols for how I want to live, with great love and openness. These are the symbols of my future, of my calling, of my identity. I'm loved, and I choose to say yes, yes, yes. Ballard Locks. Aaron and I are firecrackers, both of us. Deep feeling, mercurial, passionate, creative. We want what we want. We dream hard. We fell hard. Romance and wildness, going to plays and rock shows, talking all night, slow dancing and running around the city. We met the week I turned 22. I was a writer, a feminist, prickly about all things church and faith-related. I was fresh from 4 years in California, back home and testing the waters of a world I thought I'd never return to. I had my dukes up all the time. I'm not who you think I am. I'm not only a pastor's daughter. Please see me for more than that. Please see a poet and a fighter and a thinker. Please see me. I'd made a mess of things in Santa Barbara in some ways. In some ways, I'd made something beautiful, a person, a whole self, a messy collage of a million books and 1,000 walks on the beach and 100 late nights and 6 heartbreaks. But when I got to the end of that wild season, I wanted to reconnect all the various pieces of my life to the spiritual part of my life. And looking back, I didn't know how to do that anywhere but home. I went to work at the church my parents started, and on the first day of that new job, I met Aaron. I'd actually met him one time before. I watched his band play once when I was back for a Christmas break during college. We were talking about that moment just recently. We were 20, maybe. What would we have thought if someone had whispered to us, "That's the person who will affect your life more than any other individual forever. Your child will have her eyes, his voice." How can it be that all those years ago, something inside each of us sought out the other, believed so deeply in what the other might bring to our life? And how can it be that it's true? Aaron told me he thought I was pretty for the first time while we kayaked together at a camp in Lake Geneva. I made it awkward, of course, disagreeing with him, telling him that it was a nice thing to say, but it wasn't true, obviously, empirically. Poor dude. 22 years old, trying to talk to a girl he works with, and now she's unloading everything she learned in women's studies and every tender part of her heart all wrapped up in theories and feminism. It took me about a decade and a half to just learn to say thank you. Full disclosure, I'm still working on that one. He was a worship leader, and while I'd established pretty firmly in college that I had a thing for musicians, I did not have a thing for worship leaders. Please. I barely had a thing for worship at that point, and I read on to him all the stereotypes. He's uncomplicated, happy-clappy all the time. No depth, no darkness, no beautiful, weird complexity, no questions. I can barely even type that now. It's with great affection that I tell you Aaron is the weirdest, deepest, wildest-minded, wildest-hearted person I know. He's all questions, a galaxy of what if and why not and could it be. Everything I thought about this sweet, uncomplicated, long-haired worship leader was 1,000% wrong, and I fell hard. I thank God for that long-haired worship leader I got so wrong all those years ago. I thank God for every ounce of his dreaming, boundary-breaking, future-oriented mind and heart. I thank God for the grace he gives me time after time. I thank God for a partner who makes intentional space for who I am, even when I don't always make it for myself. I tell people all the time that I'd never be a writer without Aaron, and it's true. I believe in being sensible and safe. I hate criticism, and people writing things about me online, especially about how I look, undoes me. We've built a life and a family on love and art and messiness, and 15 years later, we're still trusting that there's plenty of space in this life we've created for two dreams, two passionate, wild-hearted makers. For many years, we traveled so much for work, together and separately, that our anniversary became little more than a blip. We'd add on a day to the work trip or get a sitter and have a quick dinner out. Then 4 years ago, Aaron surprised me and took me to New York for 2 nights, and it was so rich and needed and such a space of love and reconnection that we reset our attitude toward our anniversaries. We plan out months ahead of time where we want to go and what we want to do. This year, we went to Seattle. Earlier that month, we learned that two friends of ours, both married, both with children, had had an affair. We were absolutely, totally shocked. It plunged us into a very deep set of questions about marriage and secrecy and friendship and what it looks like to build durable, whole, healthy marriages. Aaron and I talked about it a lot, it seemed, trying to make sense of it. If this happened to them, what would stop it from happening to us? What makes a good marriage? How do you know? On the last afternoon of our anniversary trip to Seattle, we took a long walk through Ballard. We walked from one end of the neighborhood to the other, and we ended up winding across the locks on narrow metal bridges, all the way across, all the way back. And as we walked, Aaron and I talked about our marriage in a way we never had. We'd realized from watching our friends that affairs don't come out of nowhere, but that they often find a place to wedge themselves when there's an expanse of distance in a marriage, when there's a vulnerability. So we talked about our marriage over the years and our vulnerabilities. We talked about what had happened to create our most fragile seasons and what had repaired them. talked about the kinds of people and personalities and attention that we might find ourselves vulnerable to if we weren't careful. We apologized to one another for the things we did over the years to allow the distance to stretch. We talked about what shores up that distance, what ways of living and interacting help us connect in deep ways, keep the vulnerabilities from growing too great. I never imagined that you could talk about those things in a marriage. I almost can't believe we did, as we inched our way over the locks, water rushing under our feet, low gray sky above us. The trip was romantic and silly and sweet. We rode a Ferris wheel and held hands. We slept in and had a great dinner with friends. But that conversation on the locks, that's the heart of marriage. That was the stuff, I think, that we're usually afraid to say out loud, but loses its power once you share it. We talked about what we're afraid of, what we want for our lives together and separately, who we fear we could become if we're not careful. So there was wine and romance and a fancy hotel, but what mattered most was a cold gray walk across the locks, saying the things you never say, taking power out of them, and making us stronger. New fuel. I'm walking the last steps of this journey, not the life living of it, but the storytelling. I spoke with one of my editors on the phone recently. I was standing on our front porch, kicking dead leaves with my bare feet. She was in North Carolina, and I imagined her in her office, book-lined and cozy. I've never been in it, but I'm hoping it's both book-lined and cozy. I told her that I was having a hard time finishing the book, like every author has said to every editor since the beginning of time. But this time it felt different to me. Every previous run-up to publication involved mounting anxiety, jittery, fearful energy that propelled me into a bout of manic work and equally manic worrying. I'd tie myself up in knots, produce pages and pages when only a new paragraph was required, try a new recipe 5 times in a row into the middle of the night. I've always asked for help in a panicky email to friends, put myself on lockdown, canceled plans. This time is different, though. The struggle is not managing the anxiety and the fear. I'm struggling instead to drum up the necessary energy to finish, because I've always been fueled by fear and anxiety. Once you stop using those fuels to power your life, it's like jumping off a cigarette boat onto a sailboat. Disorientingly quiet, steady, calm. I love the calm. I've been aching for it for years. I love the peace and contentedness I've discovered along this journey. But those terrifying spikes of panic sure did help me get books finished. I told her that this journey from pushing to peace had changed my life, and that one of the unexpected complexities is that I didn't need what I used to need from my work. I had learned the hard way what achievement could and couldn't give me, and my newfound learning made me want to cook dinners and snuggle with my boys and read novels and not really care so much about what anyone out there thought about it. This is freedom. But is this the end of the road for a writer? I find myself confused about the career I've found myself in. If the white hot fire to be heard, to say something, to put something beautiful and honest into the vast silence isn't fanned by fear or desire to be respected or need to be seen, then what's left? Do I have anything left to say? Or should I close my laptop and stop this endless chattering, this endless need to say something, anything? Another way to say it. What powers our work when it's no longer about addiction to achievement? The last pages of this book have gone unwritten for a slightly unnerving amount of time. It's winter, and I find myself utterly not interested in finishing. I'm reading voraciously, making tacos and curries, folding laundry, taking walks. I'm going to bed early with thick novels, watching old movies with the boys, setting the table for cozy meals with friends, making menus filled with winter flavors, steak, potatoes, rosemary, garlic, wine. The stack of pages sits on my dresser, red pen resting on top. The documents on my computer go untouched for days on end. Frankly, this isn't like me. I'm a procrastinator, and like most writers, I think, I write in fits and starts. But there's a new thing happening in me right now. A detachment, almost. Writing has always been a struggle for me. I love it. I avoid it. I fear I'll never make my deadline. Most writers I know are a touch neurotic about it. I always have been. And writing has been so deeply tied to my identity. So many of my friends are writers and English majors. Bookworms, word nerds. This is what we do. The craft, the smell of old books, and on and on. A few nights ago, a friend joined us for dinner, and his daughter came too, a senior English major working on her thesis about Flannery O'Connor. Oh, I loved talking with her about narrative and theme. I wrote my senior thesis on Edith Wharton and Henry James, and when you ask for a book recommendation from me, hold on. I'm going to give you at least a dozen or 50. My love affair with books endures, or if anything, is growing. My appreciation for a well-crafted sentence or a perfectly chosen word is only rising, and my fascination with narrative and characterization and revelation, especially in memoir, is akin to an obsession. My love for reading remains, but my desire to write is conspicuously waning. And I wonder sometimes if it's because writing has become, or maybe always was, a way of proving myself, defining myself, articulating something about my identity and worth. Of course it is. Who writes 4 books in a decade without having a little something to prove? I wasn't the smart one in my English program. I know that no one put money on me being the writer among us. I was a pastor's daughter who married a charming worship leader and worked for another well-known pastor. For the first decade of my professional life, I spoke on behalf of those 3 articulate, passionate, smart men. I became an expert in crafting and supporting their voices, and I wondered deep down, in a tiny secret place, if there was room for my voice. I was fairly sure there wasn't. Late one night a couple years ago, a group was gathered around a fireplace, and one friend asked this question: what do you wish you could go back and tell yourself from 10 years ago? I said, I'd tell her, I know you can't even imagine it now, but you don't only have to speak the words of your father, your husband, your pastor. Your work doesn't have to be simply facilitating their work. You have your own voice, and you can use it. I don't know if I would have even believed that message 10 years ago, but here we are. It has been a profound honor to find and use that voice. I'm thankful every day to be a writer, to work with words and ideas and sentences, to get to tell the truth about the world as I see it. But what used to be a highly charged need to scrawl out my deepest, most honest, most intense and freighted truths has become something else. I don't need the same things I've needed from it along the way. So if it isn't about those things, why do it? If I wake up in the morning and live each day with a deep, soul-altering awareness that I'm loved just as I am, and that love is the only true currency, then the laptop starts to gather dust, and it's terribly easy to curl up with an old novel all drenched in grace and contentedness. Why do it? Because writing has become my love letter, my way of telling the love story that's changed my life. What fuels me now is love. It's slower and deeper, less combustible and exciting, but it burns within my heart with such warmth and crackle that I never want to go back to the old fuel. The words come more slowly now. The process is less frantic and jittery, and I think that's just fine. And the soul felt its worth. Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. I think it's taken me almost 40 years to actually feel the worth of my soul. All of a sudden, the words from that carol I've sung 1,000 times stop me in my tracks. He appears and the soul feels its worth. Jesus is born. Love comes down from heaven in human form, and the soul feels its worth. Because that's what I've been searching for, wringing myself out for, zigzagging the country for, a sense of my own worth. That's what we're craving, the sense that we matter, that someone sees us, that we're loved and valued. And so some of us try to earn it. Some of us try to avoid the pain of unworthiness by escaping. With drugs or shopping or sex or whatever, some of us pretend to be perfect instead of admitting that behind the image, we feel as small and unworthy as we ever have. The soul's worth, though, doesn't come from earning or proving. Image doesn't matter. Outrunning the emptiness doesn't work for long. Each soul, every soul is worthy because God made every soul, and because of his love, his son came to earth and walked among us, because God's love for us is so deep and wide and elaborate that he wants to be with us, to walk with us, to teach us how to live in that love and worthiness. It's only when you understand God's truly unconditional love that you begin to understand the worth of your own soul. not because of anything you've done, but because every soul is worthy. Every one of us is worthy of love, having been created by and in the image of the God of love. It was there all along, that thing I've been aching for, that deep sense of worthiness and love. It was there all along for all of us. For so many of us, what religion taught us was how to feel ashamed. For many years, my spiritual life was one more place to measure up and be found wanting. This awareness of love, though, this sense of the soul's worth, not because of my own doing, but because of God's great love, this changes everything. For the first time in my life, my faith is the softest part of my life, the most healing, most life-giving space in my heart. Instead of one more thing to do or try or fail at, my relationship with God is the force of love that heals up all the other bruised and broken parts. Prayer is the safest, most nurturing activity I practice, almost like sitting in the sun, face tilted up. Or imagining yourself as a child crawling up into the lap of a treasured, trusted grandparent. I can hardly believe my fingers as I type this. I left behind all the lovey-dovey, Jesus is my boyfriend business years ago. I had signed on to be a soldier, tough and faithful, bandaging my own wounds, not running to God for every little bump or bruise, but acting tough for too long makes the soft tissue of your heart start to toughen as well. It severs your relationship to your soul little by little till you find yourself doubting the importance of something as woo-woo as a soul in the first place. In 3 of the 4 Gospels, Jesus asks, "What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul?" This is another one of those verses that I've read so many times over the years, but has gained so much new meaning and weight in this season. The whole world is essentially all the things you've ever wanted, whatever success means to you, or the good life, or what it looks like to live the dream. Many of us have been living the life we've always wanted, or so it seems. But just under the surface of that lovely life is exhaustion, or isolation, or emptiness. It doesn't matter how pretty things look on the outside, if on the inside there's an ache from a lifetime of trying to prove your worth. Many of us, myself included, considered our souls necessary collateral damage to get done the things we felt we simply had to get done. Because of other people's expectations, because we want to be known as highly capable, because we're trying to outrun an inner emptiness, and for a while we don't even realize the compromise we've made. We're on autopilot, chugging through the day on fear and caffeine, checking things off the list, falling into bed without even a real thought or feeling or connection all day long. Just a sense of having made it through. We begin to think the soul is expendable, a luxury maybe, something optional, but certainly not required. But then someone starts talking about your soul, maybe at church, maybe in a book. Someone starts talking about things like grace and rest and peace and the soul feeling its worth. And that language feels so foreign and so beautiful, like water in a desert, like one bright bud pushing up in an otherwise arid landscape, and like a song you used to love but haven't heard for years. Something breaks through. That's what I've been missing. That's it. My soul. Our souls are of fundamental importance, truly the only things besides our physical bodies that we are entirely, independently responsible to steward. Many of us take care of our bodies with great attentiveness, conscious to fill our bodies with good things, to rest them well, to move and breathe deeply. After years of being careless with both my body and my soul, trusting in some vague way that they'd probably be fine no matter what, I'm learning that both body and soul require more tenderness and attentiveness than I had imagined. Our souls are what allow us to connect with God, with other people, with art, with nature. Without a soul, you can walk and drive and sleep, but you can't love, you can't weep, you can't feel, you can't make great art, or at least not for long. A soul is not required for a robot or for a machine, for a set of ideas or theories, but a soul is profoundly necessary for a human. It's from our souls that we love, that we feel, that we create, that we connect. And so Jesus' question, "What does it profit someone to gain the whole world and lose their soul?" is a way of demonstrating the paradox of getting everything you want, only to find yourself truly unable to experience those things you've worked so hard for. All those things you wanted out there, the world, as it were, art and food and connection and beauty and experiences and meaning, you cannot feel or taste or touch those things without a soul. And so what good are they to you if you gain them at the expense of the softest, most precious part of you? What kills a soul? Exhaustion, secret keeping, image management. And what brings a soul back from the dead? Honesty, connection, grace. Whatever you've achieved, wherever you've arrived, a dollar amount in the bank, a number on the scale, that award or promotion or perfect house, whatever it is, if in order to get there you laid down your soul, believing it was unnecessary baggage or an acceptable sacrifice, I'm here to tell you with great love and tenderness that you're wrong. And I'd love to take you by the hand and walk back as far as we need to, down the road of your past to find it. Like a sweater you dropped walking to class, like a scarf that slipped off your shoulders unnoticed. Bring in the love. Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. Matthew 11:28-30, The Message. It is achingly, bone-rattlingly cold in Chicago, but cloudless and blue-skied, crisp to the point of shattering, icy sidewalks and furnaces kicking on around the clock with labored thunks. Today, I was craving garlic and tomatoes, so in between the scribbling of sentences, I melted several cloves of garlic and a couple handfuls of halved grape tomatoes into oil over low heat on the stove. The sharp garlic smell filled the house and then began to mellow, as the tomatoes slipped out of their skins, blistered, softened. A steaming bowl of those melted, fragrant tomatoes and garlic were just the thing for the starkness of the day, the severe chill. My task for the day, to find the words to leave you with, to wrap my mind and heart and letters and words around the last three and whatever years and tell you something about it all. This is what I want to tell you. It's better here, here in the place of love. This journey has brought about a meaningful transformation in every single part of my life, every single part. My prayer life, my marriage, my family life, my friendships. I enjoy my work more. I feel a deep well of gratitude, a clean and grateful desire to live a life of meaning. I have the energy to live well, to dedicate myself to the things that matter to me and that God has called me to. I have the security to truly rest, truly enjoy this extraordinary world and all its offerings. Books and art and meals and people and conversations and cities and beaches and night skies. And while I am deeply appreciative of the charms of this glittering world, I feel a sense of patience where I used to feel slight anxiety about the beauty of it. Will I see it all? What if I miss something? In the space that used to be filled with a whirring ball of anxiety, now there is a new patience, a new settledness, a new desire to be just exactly where I am right now. I'm reveling in this new patience, this new groundedness, this new sense of peace. It's so foreign and so lovely. This deep well of contentedness that I feel these days is nothing short of a miracle, and it's one I'm thankful for every day. For a while, I placed my marriage, my family, and my soul on the altar of productivity, of hustle, of competency and efficiency. I can't adequately express the regret I feel for having done that, or the gratitude I feel for pulling them back down off the altar before it was too late. I don't know what would have happened if I'd continued down that road another year, or two, or 10. A couple days ago, we had lunch with two rabbis married to one another. I'd met the husband, but this was my first time meeting his wife. They were smart and funny and passionate, and we thoroughly enjoyed our time with them. At a certain point, we talked about work and life and time and parenting. I told them a little bit about the changes I'd been making, slower, less task-oriented, less driven. The husband, perceptively, turned to Aaron and asked about what this meant for him, for the shared responsibilities of our life. We all laughed, but it was a serious and valid question. Aaron said, yeah, things are messier. She's not running around cleaning and fussing all the time. I have to do more, and I'm not great at that stuff, and there's more that we just leave undone. But here's the thing. I have my wife back, and it's totally, completely worth it. That's why this journey matters, because I was on a dangerous track where I was giving the best of myself to people and things out there, while the tender inner core of my life and my home were increasingly stretched, pressurized, brittle. And now they're not. Now the most beautiful, well-tended, truly nurtured and nourished parts of my life are the innermost ones, not the flashy public ones. That's just as it should be. We are, as I've mentioned, not a family of conventional traditions. There are a couple rituals, though, that we've developed over the years that I truly love. The first, Christmas and New Year's on the beach. The week before Christmas, we open presents, celebrate with various friends and family. We're part of the many Christmas services at our church, and we watch our kids in their holiday programs. This year, Mac was the innkeeper, and Henry sang Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree with the rest of his third grade class with extremely festive motions. And then early on Christmas morning, we throw our bags in the car and meet the rest of my family at the airport for the flight south just as the sun is coming up. And on that trip, there are two more traditions. On New Year's Eve, we batter and deep fry everything in sight. This year, lobster, conch, potatoes, pickles, bananas, baby bell peppers stuffed with cheese. And then after dinner and before the countdown to midnight, we sit in a circle and take turns reading lists we've made of the 10 greatest blessings of the year. And this year, our son Henry, perceptive, articulate, old-souled, told this circle of friends and family that one of the things he was most thankful for was that his parents don't work too much to spend time with him. Tears, of course, sprang to my eyes. We don't talk with him about this stuff necessarily. We just do it and trust that he notices. And he does. He talked about several other things he's thankful for, his grandparents, his favorite teacher, Miss Gillespie, our basketball hoop, and then his 10th blessing was the word connected. He said, you know, I just feel like my mom and dad and Mac and I are really connected. Maybe you've always managed your time and your anxieties and your compulsions just perfectly. Maybe your kids have always felt super duper connected. Maybe your marriage has always been a model of intimacy, but that's not my story. I was headed for a crash, having lost touch with my essential self and the hand of God to guide me. I can't express to you how easily that connection we now experience could have been compromised forever in my panicky need to outrun my fear and hustle for my identity. My life is smaller, slower, simpler. My days are less complicated. I sleep better and wake with a heart of deep gratefulness. I've become able to appreciate silliness again and subtle beauty. Instead of the volume of my life being so screechingly loud, only fireworks could get my attention. I feel prouder of my smaller, simpler, quieter, more connected life than I ever did when all of life was screaming along. I thought I would feel deep gladness if I broke my back for my work. I broke my back for my work, and all I felt was back-breaking pain. That rush of love never did come until now, until I realized that the love I was looking for all along is never found in the hustle. You can't prove it or earn it or compete for it. You can just make space for it. Listen to it. Travel all the way down to the depth of your soul, into the rhythmic beating of your very own heart, where the very Spirit of God has made his home. And that's where you'll find it. You'll find it in the faces of the people who've known you all your life, who sit around your table every week, the children whose noses you kiss while they're sleeping. You'll find it in prayer. When you sit in silence, sensing the presence of Christ resurrected. Mac, our 4-year-old, is the snuggliest, most affectionate little person on earth. And when he wants a hug or a kiss, he'll fling out his arms and bellow, "Bring in the love!" in a deep voice like a radio DJ. And then when you scoop him up, he pats you over and over on the back with his little hands and says, "There it is. There's the love. There's the love. Here it is. Here's the love. Here's the love." It's in marriage and parenting. It's in family and friends. It's in sacrifice and forgiveness. It's in dinner around the coffee table and long walks. It's in the hands and faces of the people we see every day, in the whispers of our prayers and hymns and songs. It's in our neighborhoods and churches, our classrooms and living rooms, on the water and in the stories we tell. And let me tell you where it is not. It's not in numbers, numbers in bank accounts, numbers on scales, numbers on report cards or credit scores. The love you're looking for is never something you can calculate. It's not something you can buy or earn or hustle for. It's something you discover in the silence, in the groundedness, in the sacred, risky act of being exactly who you are, Nothing more, nothing less. In that still, holy space, the love you've been frantically hunting for all along will bloom within your ribs, and you will know in that moment that it has been there all along. Like a whisper, like the very spirit of God himself. The bad news is that there is no finish line here, no magical before and after. Probably you will not always live in this new, brave, grounded space. Let me be clear with you. I don't. I still get pushed off center, thrown into fear and proving, wound up into a tangled mess of expectations and opinions of who I should be and what I should do. But there's good news too. If we just keep coming back to the silence, if we keep grounding ourselves as often as we need to in God's wild love, if we keep showing up and choosing to be present in both the mess and in the delight, we will find our way home, even if the road is winding and full of fits and starts. We will find our way home. The Journey by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Acknowledgements. So much love to the Hybels and Nyquist families, especially Nana Lynn and Papa Bill, Uncle Todd, and Nana D and Papa D. Thanks to Melody Martinez, Amanda Hybels, Matt and Casey Sunstead, Blaine and Margaret Hogan, Brandon Anderson, Rachel Raymond, Matt and Christy Lundgren, Paul Johnson and Rihanna Godfrey, Brian and Jory Johnson, and Steve and Sarah Carter, the local daily pals who make our life rich and meaningful. Love and thanks to Annette and Andrew Richards, Emily and Ryan Gardner, Monica Robertson, Kirsten Davidson, Jen Hatmaker, Glennon Melton, and Brene Brown, dear friends who, despite distance, teach me so much. So much love to the Willow family and the Practice Tribe. You guide me and inspire me. Special thanks to Dr. Bob Watson and Mary McKeon for walking me home toward Christ, toward wholeness, toward better ways of living. Love to the Lodge family, especially Bob and Maria Goff, Don and Betsy Miller, Bryson and Emily Vogeltans, Cameron Strang, Nicole Nordeman, and Brian and Mackenzie Canlis. You all gave me the courage to change my life in ways I desperately needed. Much gratitude to Carolyn McCready, Lauren Winner, and Angela Sheff. I'm the luckiest writer on earth to work with three brilliant, loving women like you. You went above and beyond on this one. You three are spectacular, and I'm endlessly thankful. Thanks as well to Chris Faraby, my agent and my friend, and to Tim Schrader, Londa Alderink, Greg Klaus, Kurt Diepenhorst, Jennifer Verhage, and the rest of the kind and capable HarperCollins Christian team. And I'll end the way I began, with heart-bursting amounts of love for my three precious boys, Aaron, Henry, and Mac. I love you with my whole heart.
You've been listening to the audio production of Present Over Perfect, text copyright 2016 by Shauna Nyquist, production copyright 2016 by Zondervan. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Zondervan, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at zondervan.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.